good and evil, winner and loser. At Corinth, two temples stood side by side, the temple of violence and the temple of necessity. Monuments. For many reasons, due as much to economics as to metaphysics, it may be said that the Oronese style, if there is one, forcefully and clearly appears in the extraordinary edifice called the Maison du Colon. Oran hardly lacks monuments. The city has its quota of imperial marshals, ministers, and local benefactors. They are found on dusty little squares, resigned to rain and sun. They, too, converted to stone and boredom. But in any case, they represent contributions from the outside. In that happy Barbary, they are the regrettable marks of civilization. Oran, on the other hand, has raised up her altars and rostra to her own honor. In the very heart of the mercantile city, having to construct a common home for the innumerable agricultural organizations that keep this country alive, the people of Oran conceive the idea of building solidly a convincing image of their virtues, the Maison du Colon. To judge from the edifice, those virtues are three in number: boldness in taste, love of violence, and a feeling for historical syntheses. Egypt, Byzantium, and Munich collaborated in the delicate construction of a piece of pastry in the shape of a bowl upside down. Multicolored stones, most vigorous in effect, have been brought in to outline the roof. These mosaics are so exuberantly persuasive that at first you see nothing but an amorphous effulgence. But with a closer view, and your attention called to it, you discover that they have a meaning. A graceful colonist, wearing a bow tie and white pith helmet, is receiving the homage of a procession of slaves dressed in classical style. The edifice and its colored illustrations have been set down in the middle of a square in the to and fro of the little two-car trams, whose filth is one of the charms of the city. Oran greatly cherishes also the two lions of its place d'armes, or parade ground. Since 1888, they have been sitting in state on opposite sides of the municipal stairs. Their author was named Kane. They have majesty and a stubby torso. It is said that at night they get down from their pedestal, one after the other, silently pace around the dark square, and on occasion urinate at length under the big dusty ficus trees. These, of course, are rumors to which the people of Oran lend an indulgent ear, but it is unlikely. Despite a certain amount of research, I have not been able to get interested in Kane. I merely learned that he had the reputation of being a skillful animal sculptor. Yet I often think of him. This is an intellectual bent that comes naturally in Oran. Here is a sonorously named artist who left an unimportant work here. Several hundred thousand people are familiar with the easygoing beasts he put in front of a pretentious town hall. This is one way of succeeding in art. To be sure, these two lions, like thousands of works of the same type, are proof of something else than talent. Others have created the Night Watch, St. Francis receiving the Stigmata, David, or the Pharsalian bas-relief called the Glorification of the Flower. Kane, on the other hand, set up two hilarious snouts on the square of a mercantile province overseas. But the David will go down one day with Florence, and the lions will perhaps be saved from the catastrophe. Let me repeat, they are proof of something else. Can one state this idea clearly? In this work there are insignificance and solidity. Spirit counts for nothing, and matter for a great deal. Mediocrity insists upon lasting by all means, including bronze. It is refused a right to eternity, and every day it takes that right. Is it not eternity itself? In any event, such perseverance is capable of stirring, and it involves its lesson, that of all the monuments of Oran and of Oran herself. An hour a day, every so often, it forces you to pay attention to something that has no importance. The mind profits from such recurrences. In a sense, this is its hygiene, and since it absolutely needs its moments of humility, it seems to me that this chance to indulge in stupidity is better than others. Everything that is ephemeral wants to last. Let us say that everything wants to last. Human productions mean nothing else, and in this regard, Cain's lions have the same chances as the ruins of Angkor. This disposes one toward modesty. There are other Oranese monuments, or at least they deserve this name because they too stand for their city, and perhaps in a more significant way. They are the public works at present covering the coast for some 10 kilometers. Apparently, it is a matter of transforming the most luminous of bays into a gigantic harbor. In reality, it is one more chance for man to come to grips with stone. In the paintings of certain Flemish masters, a theme of strikingly general application recurs insistently. The building of the Tower of Babel. Vast landscapes, rocks climbing up to heaven, steep slopes teeming with workmen, animals, ladders, strange machines, cords, pulleys. Man, moreover, is there only to give scale to the inhuman scope of the construction. This is what the Oran coast makes one think of west of the city. Clinging to vast slopes, rails, dump cars, cranes, tiny trains, under a broiling sun, toy-like locomotives round huge blocks of stone amid whistles, dust, and smoke. Day and night, a nation of ants bustles about on the smoking carcass of the mountain. Clinging all up and down a single cord against the side of the cliff, dozens of men, their bellies pushing against the handles of automatic drills, vibrate in empty space all day long, and break off whole masses of rock that hurtle down in dust and rumbling. Farther on, dump carts tip their loads over the slopes, and the rocks, suddenly poured seaward, bound and roll into the water, each large lump followed by a scattering of lighter stones. At regular intervals, at dead of night or in broad daylight, detonations shake the whole mountain and stir up the sea itself. Man, in this vast construction field, makes a frontal attack on stone. And if one could forget, for a moment at least, the harsh slavery that makes this work possible, one would have to admire. These stones, torn from the mountain, serve man and his plans. They pile up under the first waves, gradually emerge, and finally take their place to form a jetty, soon covered with men and machines which advance day after day toward the open sea. Without stopping, huge steel jaws bite into the cliff's belly, turn round, and disgorge into the water their overflowing gravel. As the coastal cliff is lowered, the whole coast encroaches irresistibly on the sea. Of course, destroying stone is not possible. It is merely moved from one place to another. In any case, it will last longer than the men who use it. For the moment, it satisfies their will to action. That in itself is probably useless. But moving things about is the work of men. One must choose doing that or nothing. Obviously, the people of Oran have chosen. In front of that indifferent bay, for many years more, they will pile up stones along the coast. In 100 years, tomorrow, in other words, they will have to begin again. But today, these heaps of rocks testify for the men in masks of dust and sweat who move about among them. The true monuments of Oran are still her stones. Ariadne's Stone. It seems that the people of Oran are like that friend of Flaubert, who on the point of death, casting a last glance at this irreplaceable earth, exclaimed, "Close the window! It's too beautiful!" They have closed the window. They have walled themselves in. They have cast out the landscape. But Flaubert's friend, Le Poitevin, died, and after him days continued to be added to days. Likewise, beyond the yellow walls of Oran, land and sea continue their indifferent dialogue. That permanence in the world has always had contrary charms for man. It drives him to despair and excites him. The world never says but one thing. First it interests, then it bores. But eventually it wins out by dint of obstinacy. It is always right. Already at the very gates of Oran, nature raises its voice. In the direction of Canastel, there are vast wastelands covered with fragrant brush. There sun and wind speak only of solitude. Above Oran, there is the mountain of Santa Cruz, the plateau and the myriad ravines leading to it. Roads once carriageable cling to the slopes overhanging the sea. In the month of January, some are covered with flowers. Daisies and buttercups turn them into sumptuous paths, embroidered in yellow and white. About Santa Cruz, everything has been said. But if I were to speak of it, I should forget the sacred processions that climb the rugged hill on feast days, in order to recall other pilgrimages. Solitary, they walk in the red stone, rise above the motionless bay, and come to dedicate to nakedness a luminous, perfect hour. Oran has also its deserts of sand, its beaches. Those encountered near the gates are deserted only in winter and spring. Then they are plateaus covered with asphodels, peopled with bare little cottages among the flowers. The sea rumbles a bit down below. Yet already the sun, the faint breeze, the whiteness of the asphodels, the sharp blue of the sky, everything makes one fancy summer. The golden youth then covering the beach, the long hours on the sand, and the sudden softness of evening. Each year on these shores there is a new harvest of girls in flower. Apparently they have but one season. The following year, other cordial blossoms take their place, which the summer before were still little girls with bodies as hard as buds. At 11 a.m., coming down from the plateau, all that young flesh, lightly clothed in motley materials, breaks on the sand like a multicolored wave. One has to go farther, strangely close, however, to that spot where 200,000 men are laboring, to discover a still virgin landscape. Long deserted dunes, where the passage of men has left no other trace than a worm-eaten hut. From time to time an Arab shepherd drives along the top of the dunes the black and beige spots of his flock of goats. On the beaches of the Oran country, every summer morning seems to be the first in the world. Each twilight seems to be the last, solemn agony, announced at sunset by a final glow that darkens every hue. The sea is ultramarine, the road the color of clotted blood, the beach yellow. Everything disappears with the green sun. An hour later, the dunes are bathed in moonlight. Then there are incomparable nights under a rain of stars. Occasionally storms sweep over them, and the lightning flashes flow along the dunes, whiten the sky, and give the sand and one's eyes orange-colored glints. But this cannot be shared. One has to have lived it. So much solitude and nobility gives these places an unforgettable aspect. In the warm moment before daybreak, after confronting the first bitter black waves, a new creature breasts night's heavy enveloping water. The memory of those joys does not make me regret them, and thus I recognize that they were good. After so many years, they still last, somewhere in this heart which finds unswerving loyalty so difficult. And I know that today, if I were to go to the deserted dune, the same sky would pour down on me its cargo of breezes and stars. These are lands of innocence. But innocence needs sand and stones, and man has forgotten how to live among them. At least, it seems so, for he has taken refuge in this extraordinary city where boredom sleeps. Nevertheless, that very confrontation constitutes the value of Oran. The capital of boredom, besieged by innocence and beauty, it is surrounded by an army in which every stone is a soldier. In the city, and at certain hours, however, what a temptation to go over to the enemy! What a temptation to identify oneself with those stones, to melt into that burning and impassive universe that defies history and its ferments! That is doubtless futile. But there is in every man a profound instinct which is neither that of destruction nor that of creation. It is merely a matter of resembling nothing. In the shadow of the warm walls of Oran, on its dusty asphalt, that invitation is sometimes heard. It seems that, for a time, the minds that yield to it are never disappointed. This is the darkness of Eurydice and the sleep of Isis. Here are the deserts where thought will collect itself, the cool hand of evening on a troubled heart. On this Mount of Olives, vigil is futile. The mind recalls and approves the sleeping apostles. Were they really wrong? They nonetheless had their revelation. Just think of Sakyamuni in the desert. He remained there for years on end, squatting motionless with his eyes on heaven. The very gods envied him that wisdom and that stone-like destiny. In his outstretched hands, the swallows had made their nest. But one day they flew away, answering the call of distant lands. And he who had stifled in himself desire and will, fame and suffering, began to cry. It happens thus that flowers grow on rocks. Yes, let us accept stone when it is necessary. That secret and that rapture we ask of faces can also be given us by stone. To be sure, this cannot last. But what can last, after all? The secret of faces fades away, and there we are, cast back to the chain of desires. And if stone can do no more for us than the human heart, at least it can do just as much. Oh, to be nothing! For thousands of years this great cry has roused millions of men to revolt against desire and pain. Its dying echoes have reached this far, across centuries and oceans, to the oldest sea in the world. They still reverberate dully against the compact cliffs of Iran. Everybody in this country follows this advice without knowing it. Of course, it is almost futile. Nothingness cannot be achieved any more than the absolute can. But since we receive as favors the eternal signs brought us by roses or by human suffering, let us not refuse either the rare invitations to sleep that the earth addresses us. Each has as much truth as the other. This, perhaps, is the Ariadne's thread of this somnambulist and frantic city. Here one learns the virtues, provisional, to be sure, of a certain kind of boredom. In order to be spared, one must say yes to the Minotaur. This is an old and fecund wisdom. Above the sea, silent at the base of the red cliffs, it is enough to maintain a delicate equilibrium halfway between the two massive headlands, which, on the right and left, dip into the clear water. In the puffing of a Coast Guard vessel crawling along the water, far out bathed in radiant light, is distinctly heard the muffled call of inhuman and glittering forces. It is the Minotaur's farewell. It is noon. The very day is being weighed in the balance. His rite accomplished, the traveler receives the reward of his liberation. The little stone, dry and smooth as an asphodel, that he picks up on the cliff. For the initiate, the world is no heavier to bear than this stone. Atlas's task is easy. It is sufficient to choose one's hour. Then one realizes that for an hour, a month, a year, these shores can indulge in freedom. They welcome pell-mell, without even looking at them, the monk, the civil servant, or the conqueror. There are days when I expected to meet in the streets of Iran Descartes or Cesare Borgia. That did not happen, but perhaps another will be more fortunate. A great deed, a great work, virile meditation used to call for the solitude of sands or of the convent. There were kept the spiritual vigils of arms. Where could they be better celebrated now than in the emptiness of a big city established for some time in unintellectual beauty? Here is the little stone, smooth as an asphodel. It is at the beginning of everything. Flowers, tears, if you insist, departures and struggles are for tomorrow. In the middle of the day, when the sky opens its fountains of light in the vast sonorous space, all the headlands of the coast look like a fleet about to set out. Those heavy galleons of rock and light are trembling on their keels as if they were preparing to steer for sunlit isles. O mornings in the country of Oran! From the high plateaus, the swallows plunge into huge troughs where the air is seething. The whole coast is ready for departure. A shiver of adventure ripples through it. Tomorrow, perhaps, we shall leave together. 1939. Helen's Exile. The Mediterranean sun has something tragic about it, quite different from the tragedy of fogs. Certain evenings at the base of the seaside mountains, night falls over the flawless curve of a little bay, and there rises from the silent waters a sense of anguished fulfillment. In such spots one can understand that if the Greeks knew despair, they always did so through beauty and its stifling quality. In that gilded calamity, tragedy reaches its highest point. Our time, on the other hand, has fed its despair on ugliness and convulsions. This is why Europe would be vile if suffering could ever be so. We have exiled beauty. The Greeks took up arms for her. First difference, but one that has a history. Greek thought always took refuge behind the conception of limits. It never carried anything to extremes, neither the sacred nor reason, because it negated nothing, neither the sacred nor reason. It took everything into consideration, balancing shadow with light. Our Europe, on the other hand, often the pursuit of totality, is the child of disproportion. She negates beauty as she negates whatever she does not glorify. And through all her diverse ways, she glorifies but one thing, which is the future rule of reason. In her madness, she extends the eternal limits, and at that very moment, dark Erinyes fall upon her and tear her to pieces. Nemesis, the goddess of measure and not of revenge, keeps watch. All those who overstep the limit are pitilessly punished by her. The Greeks, who for centuries questioned themselves as to what is just, could understand nothing of our idea of justice. For them, equity implied a limit, whereas our whole continent is convulsed in its search for a justice that must be total. At the dawn of Greek thought, Heraclitus was already imagining that justice sets limits for the physical universe itself. The sun will not overstep his measures. If he does, the Erinyes, the handmaids of justice, will find him out. We who have cast the universe and spirit out of our sphere laugh at that threat. In a drunken sky, we light up the suns we want. But nonetheless, the boundaries exist, and we know it. In our wildest aberrations, we dream of an equilibrium we have left behind, which we naively expect to find at the end of our errors. Childish presumption, which justifies the fact that child nations, inheriting our follies, are now directing our history. A fragment attributed to the same Heraclitus simply states, "Presumption, progression of progress." And many centuries after the man of Ephesus, Socrates, facing the threat of being condemned to death, acknowledged only this one superiority in himself. What he did not know, he did not claim to know. The most exemplary life and thought of those centuries close on a profound confession of ignorance. Forgetting that, we have forgotten our virility. We have preferred the power that apes greatness. First Alexander, and then the Roman conquerors, whom the authors of our schoolbooks, through some incomparable vulgarity, teach us to admire. We too have conquered, moved boundaries, mastered heaven and earth. Our reason has driven all away. Alone, at last, we end up by ruling over a desert. What imagination could we have left for that higher equilibrium in which nature balanced history, beauty, virtue, and which applied the music of numbers even to blood tragedy? We turn our backs on nature. We are ashamed of beauty. Our wretched tragedies have a smell of the office clinging to them, and the blood that trickles from them is the color of printer's ink. This is why it is improper to proclaim today that we are the sons of Greece, or else we are the renegade sons. Placing history on the throne of God, we are progressing toward theocracy like those whom the Greeks called barbarians, and whom they fought to death in the waters of Salamis. In order to realize how we differ, one must turn to him among our philosophers who is the true rival of Plato. Only the modern city, Hegel dares write, offers the mind a field in which it can become aware of itself. We are thus living in the period of big cities. Deliberately, the world has been amputated of all that constitutes its permanence: nature, the sea, hilltops, evening meditation. Consciousness is to be found only in the streets, because history is to be found only in the streets. This is the edict. And consequently, our most significant works show the same bias. Landscapes are not to be found in great European literature since Dostoevsky. History explains neither the natural universe that existed before it, nor the beauty that exists above it. Hence, it chose to be ignorant of them. Whereas Plato contained everything, nonsense, reason, and myth, our philosophers contain nothing but nonsense or reason, because they have closed their eyes to the rest. The mole is meditating. It is Christianity that began substituting the tragedy of the soul for contemplation of the world. But at least Christianity referred to a spiritual nature and thereby preserved a certain fixity. With God dead, there remains only history and power. For some time, the entire effort of our philosophers has aimed solely at replacing the notion of human nature with that of situation, and replacing ancient harmony with the disorderly advance of chance or reason's pitiless progress. Whereas the Greeks gave to will the boundaries of reason, we have come to put the will's impulse in the very center of reason, which has as a result become deadly. For the Greeks, values preexisted all action, of which they definitely set the limits. Modern philosophy places its values at the end of action. They are not, but are becoming. And we shall know them fully only at the completion of history. With values, all limit disappears. And since conceptions differ as to what they will be, since all struggles, without the break of those same values, spread indefinitely, today's messianisms confront one another and their clamors mingle in the clash of empires. Disproportion is a conflagration, according to Heraclitus. The conflagration is spreading. Nietzsche is outdistanced. Europe no longer philosophizes by striking a hammer, but by shooting a cannon. Nature is still there, however. She contrasts her calm skies and her reasons with the madness of men. Until the atom, too, catches fire, and history ends in the triumph of reason and the agony of the species. But the Greeks never said that the limit could not be overstepped. They said it existed, and that whoever dared to exceed it was mercilessly struck down. Nothing in present history can contradict them. The historical spirit and the artist both want to remake the world. But the artist, through an obligation of his nature, knows his limits, which the historical spirit fails to recognize. This is why the latter's aim is tyranny, whereas the former's passion is freedom. All those who are struggling for freedom today are ultimately fighting for beauty. Of course, it is not a question of defending beauty for itself. Beauty cannot do without man, and we shall not give our era its nobility and serenity unless we follow it in its misfortune. Never again shall we be hermits. But it is no less true that man cannot do without beauty, and this is what our era pretends to want to disregard. It steels itself to attain the absolute and authority. It wants to transfigure the world before having exhausted it, to set it to rights before having understood it. Whatever it may say, our era is deserting this world. Ulysses can choose at Calypso's bidding between immortality and the land of his fathers. He chooses the land, and death with it. Such simple nobility is foreign to us today. Others will say that we lack humility, but all things considered, this word is ambiguous. Like Dostoevsky's fools who boast of everything, soar to heaven, and end up flaunting their shame in any public place, we merely lack man's pride, which is fidelity to his limits, lucid love of his condition. "I hate my time," Saint-Exupéry wrote shortly before his death, for reasons not far removed from those I have spoken of. But however upsetting that exclamation, coming from him who loved men for their admirable qualities, we shall not accept responsibility for it. Yet what a temptation at certain moments to turn one's back on this bleak, fleshless world. But this time is ours, and we cannot live hating ourselves. It has fallen so low only through the excess of its virtues as well as through the extent of its vices. We shall fight for the virtue that has a history. What virtue? The horses of Patroclus weep for their master killed in battle. All is lost. But Achilles resumes the fight, and victory is the outcome because friendship has just been assassinated. Friendship is a virtue. Admission of ignorance, rejection of fanaticism, the limits of the world and of man, the beloved face, and finally, beauty. This is where we shall be on the side of the Greeks. In a certain sense, the direction history will take is not the one we think. It lies in the struggle between creation and inquisition. Despite the price which artists will pay for their empty hands, we may hope for their victory. Once more, the philosophy of darkness will break and fade away over the dazzling sea. O midday thought, the Trojan War is being fought far from the battlefields. Once more the dreadful walls of the modern city will fall to deliver up, soul serene as the ocean's calm, the beauty of Helen. 1948. Return to Tipaza. From Medea. You have navigated with raging soul far from the paternal home, passing beyond the sea's double rocks, and you now inhabit a foreign land. For 5 days rain had been falling ceaselessly on Algiers, and had finally wet the sea itself. From an apparently inexhaustible sky, constant downpours, viscous in their density, streamed down upon the gulf. Gray and soft as a huge sponge, the sea rose slowly in the ill-defined bay. But the surface of the water seemed almost motionless under the steady rain. Only now and then a barely perceptible swelling motion would raise above the sea's surface a vague puff of smoke that would come to dock in the harbor under an arc of wet boulevards. The city itself, all its white walls dripping, gave off a different steam that went out to meet the first steam. Whichever way you turned, you seemed to be breathing water, to be drinking the air. In front of the soaked sea, I walked and waited in that December Algiers, which was for me the city of summers. I'd fled Europe's night, the winter of faces. But the summer city herself had been emptied of her laughter and offered me only bent and shining backs. In the evening, in the crudely lighted cafes where I took refuge, I read my age in faces I recognized without being able to name them. I merely knew that they had been young with me, and that they were no longer so. Yet I persisted without very well knowing what I was waiting for, unless perhaps the moment to go back to Tipaza. To be sure, it is sheer madness, almost always punished, to return to the sights of one's youth and try to relive at 40 what one loved or keenly enjoyed at 20. But I was forewarned of that madness. Once already I'd returned to Tipaza, soon after those war years that marked for me the end of youth. I hoped, I think, to recapture there a freedom I could not forget. In that spot, indeed, more than 20 years ago, I had spent whole mornings wandering among the ruins, breathing in the wormwood, warming myself against the stones, discovering little roses, soon plucked of their petals, which outlived the spring. Only at noon, at the hour when the cicadas themselves fell silent, as if overcome, I would flee the greedy glare of an all-consuming light. Sometimes at night I would sleep open-eyed under a sky dripping with stars. I was alive then. 15 years later I found my ruins. A few feet from the first waves, I followed the streets of the forgotten walled city through fields covered with bitter trees, and on the slopes overlooking the bay I still caressed the bread-colored columns. But the ruins were now surrounded with barbed wire, and could be entered only through certain openings. It was also forbidden, for reasons which it appears that morality approves, to walk there at night. By day one encountered an official guardian. It just happened, that morning, that it was raining over the whole extent of the ruins. Disoriented, walking through the wet, solitary countryside, I tried at least to recapture that strength, hitherto always at hand, that helps me to accept what is, when once I have admitted that I cannot change it. And I could not, indeed, reverse the course of time and restore to the world the appearance I had loved, which had disappeared in a day long before. The 2nd of September, 1939, in fact. I had not gone to Greece, as I was to do. War, on the contrary, had come to us. Then it had spread over Greece herself. That distance, those years separating the warm ruins from the barbed wire, were to be found in me, too. That day as I stood before the sarcophaguses full of black water, or under the sodden tamarisks. Originally brought up surrounded by beauty, which was my only wealth, I had begun in plenty. Then had come the barbed wire. I mean tyrannies, war, police forces, the era of revolt. One had had to put oneself right with the authorities of night. The day's beauty was but a memory. And in this muddy Tipaza, the memory itself was becoming dim. It was indeed a question of beauty, plenty, or youth. In the light from conflagrations, the world had suddenly shown its wrinkles and its wounds, old and new. It had aged all at once, and we with it. I had come here looking for a certain lift, but I realized that it inspires only the man who is unaware that he is about to launch forward. No love without a little innocence. Where was the innocence? Empires were tumbling down. Nations and men were tearing at one another's throats. Our hands were soiled. Originally innocent without knowing it, we were now guilty without meaning to be. The mystery was increasing with our knowledge. This is why, O mockery, we were concerned with morality. Weak and disabled, I was dreaming of virtue. In the days of innocence, I didn't even know that morality existed. I knew it now, and I was not capable of living up to its standard. On the promontory that I used to love, among the wet columns of the ruined temple, I seemed to be walking behind someone whose steps I could still hear on the stone slabs and mosaics, but whom I should never again overtake. I went back to Paris, and remained several years before returning home. Yet I obscurely missed something during all those years. When one has once had the good luck to love intensely, life is spent in trying to recapture that ardor and that illumination. Forsaking beauty and the sensual happiness attached to it, exclusively serving misfortune, calls for nobility I lack. But after all, nothing is true that forces one to exclude. Isolated beauty ends up simpering. Solitary justice ends up oppressing. Whoever aims to serve one exclusive of the other serves no one, not even himself, and eventually serves injustice twice. A day comes when, thanks to rigidity, Nothing causes wonder anymore. Everything is known, and life is spent in beginning over again. These are the days of exile, of desiccated life, of dead souls. To come alive again, one needs a special grace, self-forgetfulness, or a homeland. Certain mornings, on turning a corner, a delightful dew falls on the heart and then evaporates. But its coolness remains, and this is what the heart requires always. I had to set out again. And in Algiers a second time, still walking under the same downpour which seemed not to have ceased since a departure I had thought definitive, amid the same vast melancholy smelling of rain and sea, despite this misty sky, these backs fleeing under the shower, these cafes whose sulphurous light distorted faces, I persisted in hoping. Didn't I know, besides, that Algiers rains, despite their appearance of never meaning to end, nonetheless stop in an instant, like those streams in my country which rise in 2 hours, lay waste acres of land, and suddenly dry up? One evening, in fact, the rain ceased. I waited one night more. A limpid morning rose, dazzling over the pure sea. From the sky, fresh as a daisy, washed over and over again by the rains, reduced by these repeated washings to its finest and clearest texture, emanated a vibrant light that gave to each house and each tree a sharp outline, an astonished newness. In the world's morning, the earth must have sprung forth in such a light. I again took the road for Tipaza. For me, there is not a single one of those 69 kilometers that is not filled with memories and sensations. Turbulent childhood, adolescent daydreams in the drone of the bus's motor, mornings, unspoiled girls, beaches, young muscles always at the peak of their effort, evenings, slight anxiety in a 16-year-old heart, lust for life, fame, and ever the same sky throughout the years, unfailing in strength and light, itself insatiable, consuming one by one over a period of months, the victims stretched out in the form of crosses on the beach at the death-like hour of noon. Always the same sea, too. Almost impalpable in the morning light, which I again saw on the horizon as soon as the road, leaving the Sahel and its bronze-colored vineyards, sloped down toward the coast. But I did not stop to look at it. I wanted to see again the Chinois, that solid heavy mountain cut out of a single block of stone, which borders the bay of Tipaza to the west before dropping down into the sea itself. It is seen from a distance, long before arriving, a light blue haze still confused with the sky. But gradually it is condensed as you advance toward it until it takes on the color of the surrounding waters. A huge, motionless wave whose amazing leap upward has been brutally solidified above the sea calmed all at once. Still nearer, almost at the gates of Tipaza, here it is frowning bulk, brown and green. Here is the old mossy god that nothing will ever shake, a refuge and harbor for its sons, of whom I am one. While watching it, I finally got through the barbed wire and found myself among the ruins. And under the glorious December light, as happens but once or twice in lives which ever after can consider themselves favored to the full, I found exactly what I had come seeking. What, despite the era and the world, was offered me, truly to me alone, in that forsaken nature. From the forum strewn with olives could be seen the village down below. No sound came from it. Wisps of smoke rose in the limpid air. The sea likewise was silent, as if smothered under the unbroken shower of dazzling cold light. From the Chinois, a distant cock's crow alone celebrated the day's fragile glory. In the direction of the ruins, as far as the eye could see, there was nothing but pockmarked stones and wormwood, trees and perfect columns in the transparence of the crystalline air. It seemed as if the morning were stabilized. The sun stopped for an incalculable moment. In this light and this silence, years of wrath and night melted slowly away. I listened to an almost forgotten sound within myself, as if my heart, long stopped, were calmly beginning to beat again. And awake now, I recognized one by one the imperceptible sounds of which the silence was made up. The figured bass of the birds, the sea's faint, brief sighs at the foot of the rocks, the vibration of the trees, the blind singing of the columns, the rustling of the wormwood plants, the furtive lizards. I heard that. I also listened to the happy torrents rising within me. It seemed to me that I had at last come to harbor, for a moment at least, and that henceforth that moment would be endless. But soon after, the sun rose visibly a degree in the sky. A magpie preluded briefly, and at once, from all directions, birds' songs burst out with energy, jubilation, joyful discordance, and infinite rapture. The day started up again. It was to carry me to evening. At noon on the half-sandy slopes covered with heliotropes, like a foam left by the furious waves of the last few days as they withdrew, I watched the sea barely swelling at that hour with an exhausted motion, and I satisfied the two thirsts one cannot long neglect without drying up. I mean loving and admiring. For there is merely bad luck in not being loved. There is misfortune in not loving. All of us today are dying of this misfortune. For violence and hatred dry up the heart itself. The long fight for justice exhausts the love that nevertheless gave birth to it. In the clamor in which we live, love is impossible and justice does not suffice. This is why Europe hates daylight and is only able to set injustice up against injustice. But in order to keep justice from shriveling up like a beautiful orange fruit containing nothing but a bitter dry pulp, I discovered once more at Tipaza that one must keep intact in oneself a freshness, a cool wellspring of joy, love the day that escapes injustice, and return to combat, having won that light. Here I recaptured the former beauty, the young sky, and I measured my luck, realizing at last that in the worst years of our madness, the memory of that sky had never left me. This was what in the end had kept me from despairing. I had always known that the ruins of Tipaza were younger than our new constructions or our bomb damage. There the world began over again every day in an ever new light. Oh, light! This is the cry of all the characters of ancient drama brought face to face with their fate. This last resort was ours too, and I knew it now. In the middle of winter I at last discovered that there was in me an invincible summer. I have again left Tipaza. I have returned to Europe and its struggles. But the memory of that day still uplifts me, and helps me to welcome equally what delights and what crushes. In the difficult hour we are living, what else can I desire than to exclude nothing, and to learn how to braid with white thread and black thread a single cord stretched to the breaking point? In everything I have done or said up to now, I seem to recognize these two forces, even when they work at cross purposes. I have not been able to disown the light into which I was born, and yet I have not wanted to reject the servitudes of this time. It would be too easy to contrast here with the sweet name of Tipaza other more sonorous and crueler names. For men of today there is an inner way, which I know well from having taken it in both directions, leading from the spiritual hilltops to the capitals of crime. And doubtless one can always rest, fall asleep on the hilltop, or bored with crime. But if one forgoes a part of what is, one must forgo being oneself. One must forgo living or loving otherwise than by proxy. There is thus a will to live without rejecting anything of life, which is the virtue I honor most in this world. From time to time, at least, it is true that I should like to have practiced it. Inasmuch as few epochs require as much as ours that one should be equal to the best as to the worst, I should like indeed to shirk nothing and to keep faithfully a double memory. Yes, there is beauty, and there are the humiliated. Whatever may be the difficulties of the undertaking, I should like never to be unfaithful either to one or to the others. But this still resembles a moral code, and we live for something that goes farther than morality. If we could only name it, what silence! On the hill of Sansalsa, to the east of Tipaza, the evening is inhabited. It is still light, to tell the truth, but in this light an almost invisible fading announces the day's end. A wind rises, young like the night, and suddenly the waveless sea chooses a direction and flows like a great barren river from one end of the horizon to the other. The sky darkens. Then begins the mystery, the gods of night, the beyond pleasure. But how to translate this? The little coin I am carrying away from here has a visible surface, a woman's beautiful face, which repeats to me all I have learned in this day, and a worn surface which I feel under my fingers during the return. What can that lipless mouth be saying, except what I am told by another mysterious voice within me, which every day informs me of my ignorance and my happiness? The secret I am seeking lies hidden in a valley full of olive trees. and to the grass and the cold violets, around an old house that smells of wood smoke. For more than 20 years I rambled over that valley and others resembling it. I questioned mute goatherds. I knocked at the door of deserted ruins. Occasionally, at the moment of the first star in the still bright sky, under a shower of shimmering light, I thought I knew. I did know, in truth. I still know, perhaps. But no one wants any of this secret. I don't want any myself, doubtless, and I cannot stand apart from my people. I live in my family, which thinks it rules over rich and hideous cities built of stones and mists. Day and night it speaks up, and everything bows before it, which bows before nothing. It is deaf to all secrets. Its power that carries me bores me, nevertheless, and on occasion its shouts weary me. But its misfortune is mine, and we are of the same blood. A cripple, likewise, an accomplice, and noisy, have I not shouted among the stones? Consequently, I strive to forget. I walk in our cities of iron and fire. I smile bravely at the night. I hail the storms. I shall be faithful. I have forgotten, in truth. Active and deaf, henceforth. But perhaps some day, when we are ready to die of exhaustion and ignorance, I shall be able to disown our garish tombs and go and stretch out in the valley, under the same light, and learn for the last time what I know. 1952. The Artist and His Time. 1. As an artist, have you chosen the role of witness? This would take considerable presumption, or a vocation I lack. Personally, I don't ask for any role, and I have but one real vocation. As a man, I have a preference for happiness. As an artist, it seems to me that I still have characters to bring to life without the help of wars or of law courts. But I have been sought out, as each individual has been sought out. Artists of the past could at least keep silent in the face of tyranny. The tyrannies of today are improved. They no longer admit of silence or neutrality. One has to take a stand, be either for or against. Well, in that case, I am against. But this does not amount to choosing the comfortable role of witness. It is merely accepting the time as it is, minding one's own business, in short. Moreover, you are forgetting that today judges, accused, and witnesses exchange positions with exemplary rapidity. My choice, if you think I am making one, would at least be never to sit on a judge's bench, or beneath it, like so many of our philosophers. Aside from that, there is no dearth of opportunities for action in the relative. Trade unionism is today the first and the most fruitful among them. 2. Is not the quixotism that has been criticized in your recent works an idealistic and romantic definition of the artist's role? However words are perverted, they provisionally keep their meaning. And it is clear to me that the romantic is the one who chooses the perpetual motion of history, the grandiose epic, and the announcement of a miraculous event at the end of time. If I have tried to define something, it is, on the contrary, simply the common existence of history and of man, everyday life with the most possible light thrown upon it, the dogged struggle against one's own degradation and that of others. It is likewise idealism, and of the worst kind, to end up by hanging all action and all truth on a meaning of history that is not implicit in events, and that, in any case, implies a mythical aim. Would it therefore be realism to take as the laws of history the future, in other words, just what is not yet history, something of whose nature we know nothing? It seems to me, on the contrary, that I am arguing in favor of a true realism against a mythology that is both illogical and deadly, and against romantic nihilism, whether it be bourgeois or allegedly revolutionary. To tell the truth, far from being romantic, I believe in the necessity of a rule and an order. I merely say that there can be no question of just any rule whatsoever, and that it would be surprising if the rule we need were given us by this disordered society, or, on the other hand, by those doctrinaires who declare themselves liberated from all rules and all scruples. 3. The Marxists and their followers likewise think they are humanists, but for them human nature will be formed in the classless society of the future. To begin with, this proves that they reject, at the present moment, what we all are. Those humanists are accusers of man. How can we be surprised that such a claim could have developed in the world of court trials? They reject the man of today in the name of the man of the future. That claim is religious in nature. Why should it be more justified than the one which announces the kingdom of heaven to come? In reality, the end of history cannot have, within the limits of our condition, any definable significance. It can only be the object of a faith and of a new mystification. A mystification that today is no less great than the one that of old based colonial oppression on the necessity of saving the souls of infidels. 4. Is not that what in reality separates you from the intellectuals of the left? You mean, that is what separates those intellectuals from the left? Traditionally, the left has always been at war against injustice, obscurantism, and oppression. It always thought that those phenomena were interdependent. The idea that obscurantism can lead to justice, the national interest to liberty, is quite recent. The truth is that certain intellectuals of the left, not all, fortunately, are today hypnotized by force and efficacy as our intellectuals of the right were before and during the war. Their attitudes are different, but the act of resignation is the same. The first wanted to be realistic nationalists, the second want to be realistic socialists. In the end, they betray nationalism and socialism alike in the name of a realism henceforth without content and adored as a pure and illusory technique of efficacy. This is a temptation that can, after all, be understood. But still, however the question is looked at, the new position of the people who call themselves, or think themselves, leftists consists in saying, certain oppressions are justifiable because they follow the direction which cannot be justified of history. Hence, there are presumably privileged executioners, and privileged by nothing. This is about what was said in another context by Joseph de Maistre, who has never been taken for an incendiary. But this is a thesis which, personally, I shall always reject. Allow me to set up against it the traditional point of view of what has been hitherto called the left. All executioners are of the same family. 5. What can the artist do in the world of today? He is not asked either to write about cooperatives or, conversely, to lull to sleep in himself the sufferings endured by others throughout history. And since you have asked me to speak personally, I'm going to do so as simply as I can. Considered as artists, we perhaps have no need to interfere in the affairs of the world, but considered as men, yes. The miner who is exploited or shot down, the slaves in the camps, those in the colonies, the legions of persecuted throughout the world, they need all those who can speak to communicate their silence and to keep in touch with them. I have not written, day after day, fighting articles and texts. I have not taken part in the common struggles because I desire the world to be covered with Greek statues and masterpieces. The man who has such a desire does exist in me. Except that he has something better to do in trying to instill life into the creatures of his imagination. But from my first articles to my latest book, I have written so much, and perhaps too much, only because I cannot keep from being drawn toward everyday life, toward those, whoever they may be, who are humiliated and debased. They need to hope. And if all keep silent, or if they are given a choice between two kinds of humiliation, they will be forever deprived of hope, and we with them. It seems to me impossible to endure that idea, nor can he who cannot endure it lie down to sleep in his tower. Not through virtue, as you see, but through a sort of almost organic intolerance, which you feel or do not feel. Indeed, I see many who fail to feel it, but I cannot envy their sleep. This does not mean, however, that we must sacrifice our artist nature to some social preaching or other. I have said elsewhere why the artist was more than ever necessary. But if we intervene as men, that experience will have an effect upon our language. And if we are not artists in our language, first of all, what sort of artists are we? Even if, militants in our lives, we speak in our works of deserts and of selfish love, the mere fact that our lives are militant causes a special tone of voice to people with men that desert and that love. I shall certainly not choose the moment when we are beginning to leave nihilism behind to stupidly deny the values of creation in favor of the values of humanity, or vice versa. In my mind, neither one is ever separated from the other, and I measure the greatness of an artist, Molière, Tolstoy, Melville, by the balance he managed to maintain between the two. Today, under the pressure of events, we are obliged to transport that tension into our lives likewise. This is why so many artists, bending under the burden, take refuge in the ivory tower, or conversely, in the social church. But as for me, I see in both choices a like act of resignation. We must simultaneously serve suffering and beauty. The long patience, the strength, the secret cunning such service calls for, and the virtues that establish the very renaissance we need. One word more. This undertaking, I know, cannot be accomplished without dangers and bitterness. We must accept the dangers. The era of chair-bound artists is over. But we must reject the bitterness. One of the temptations of the artist is to believe himself solitary, and in truth, he hears this shouted at him with a certain base delight. But this is not true. He stands in the midst of all, in the same rank, neither higher nor lower, with all those who are working and struggling. His very vocation in the face of oppression is to open the prisons and to give a voice to the sorrows and joys of all. This is where art, against its enemies, justifies itself by proving precisely that it is no one's enemy. By itself, art could probably not produce the renaissance which implies justice and liberty. But without it, that renaissance would be without forms, and consequently would be nothing. Without culture, and the relative freedom it implies, society, even when perfect, is but a jungle. This is why any authentic creation is a gift to the future. 1953. The End. This is Eduardo Ballerini. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Myth of Sisyphus and Other Essays by Albert Camus, translated by Justin O'Brien. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.